Like literally two lines or something like
yeah.
that.
Ti vola fronte in coronor di rose.
Thank you very much.
No, that's
it's going to be a memorable podcast for me just based on that.
Hello, this is the Great Battlefield Podcast. I'm Nathaniel G. Perlman. A great political battle is being fought right now between progressives and the forces of reaction on the other side. This show is about the political entrepreneurs and other progressive leaders who are finding new or improved ways to fight.
My guest today is Nathaniel G. Perlman, the host of the Great Battlefield Podcast and an entrepreneur with an interest in and commitment to progressive politics. For over 1,000 episodes now, I've been the interviewer, talking to a variety of great people working to protect and improve our democracy. For this, the third part of my 1,000th episode, I get to be the guest on my own show. You might want to listen to the first two parts if you haven't already. Again, I've invited former guests and a few others to do a group interview of me. So a fair number, too many really, have submitted questions in audio form. Some were straightforward, some were challenging or provocative, and some were out of my expertise, but I'm trying to answer them all. I've been stitching those questions and answers together into this three-part episode. The first was mostly biographical and personal. The second two are an extension of that, but more about politics, political technology, the podcast, my former company, NGP Van /Bonterra, and our democracy. So, after a quick word from my sponsor, this is episode 1000, part 3, with more questions of Nathaniel, host of the Great Battlefield Podcast.
Check out the large, detailed, and high-quality political data graphic posters from TimePlots. Our visual history of the American presidency, for example, lets you see the Clinton, Bush, Obama, and Trump presidencies in full context. TimePlots library includes visual histories of the United States House, the United States Senate, the Supreme Court, and the Democratic and Republican parties. Find them all at www.timeplots.com. Use the code BATTLEFIELD for a discount.
Hi, Nathaniel. It's Amanda Colombe calling in, I guess, for your 1,000th episode. And first, I just want to say congratulations. What an incredible accomplishment. And two, thank you. Whenever I am curious or have a question or I'm interested in someone or something or some organization in the space, you've really created an incredible research and resource library for all of us who work here. And I always find myself turning to your podcast and being able to find an answer in a really interesting conversation about any of those things to really kind of deep dive and get up to speed. So thank you for that. My question is, what is the most surprising conversation you've had and why?
Hi, Amanda, former general manager at NGP Van, now working on other stuff like MIG that we should talk about on the podcast sometime. Maybe it will not surprise you that I don't have a single most surprising podcast conversation out of the 1,000 plus I've had now. But I was pretty surprised when Nancy Stalnaker revealed in episode 488 that there was a Generation Data theme song and proceeded to sing it in full on that podcast. Here is a very short extract.
For context, the song Seasons of Love is all about unusual ways to measure something. 525,600 door knocks, 525,000 attempts a dear, 525,600 phone calls. How do you measure a campaign year?
Nancy's efforts left me prepared almost 500 episodes later when I was talking to Jahnavi Rao of New Voters, who mentioned that she was a singer too, having recently performed her favorite opera, Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, as an undergraduate at Harvard. Jahnavi was willing to sing a few lines. Like literally two lines or something. Like
yeah.
Ti vola fronte in coronor di rose. Ti vola fronte in
Thank you very much.
No, that's
it's going to be a memorable podcast for me just based on that.
So my two rather different singers is one kind of surprising. Other conversations, especially in early episodes, surprised me by showing me how much I had to learn. For instance, even before I started the podcast, I'd spoken with Julie Minter of New Media Ventures about my idea for a resistance dashboard. And she told me that there are lots of ideas like that out there, suggesting I ought to know enough to do my market research. That surprised me. And though I never ran into something quite like what I'd been proposing, her reaction was part of my impetus for starting the podcast and using it to learn about what else was going on. I did turn the tables on Julie by getting her to be my guest for episode 3 and learning through her about New Media Ventures and what they were funding. I was also impressively ignorant about many aspects of progressive terminology that had become standard in progressive spaces. Concepts like intersectional, obviously a common term now, I had not even come across until episode 11 in 2017 when interviewing Melissa McEwen. I was also surprised when I learned mid-interview in episode 32, also in 2017, that my guest, Caden Mack, was a trans person, a basic failure in preparation, and frankly, I had a lot of catching up to do in my understanding about the political challenges in that area. The awareness that I've learned so much only relatively recently makes me more forgiving of the many people who find some of our terminology and concepts foreign, because things which have become second nature to us are often not part of their worlds. I was also surprised almost weekly by what I was learning. I didn't know that there were online campaigns to take down right-wing television hosts until I heard it from Angelo at Media Matters, or about the organizing going on to help domestic workers until I heard it from Ai-Jin Poo, or how the need to feel belonging seemed to attract young men to violent racist groups, which I heard from Christian Piccellini, or how direct action could be used to change climate politics, which I heard from Varshini Prakash of the Sunshine Movement, or about the whole path to disability rights from Judy Heumann, our recently passed leader in that area. These kind of surprises kept coming for me every week and helped me grow and made me want to keep at it. If I can be comfortable admitting my ignorance and pursuing my curiosity, I then have the opportunity to learn this way and share it with those who are also interested. So thanks, Amanda, for the question about my most surprising episode. I seem to have turned it into a bit of a disquisition on the podcast.
You've conducted 1,000 interviews on this podcast and likely hundreds or thousands more in your career while leading different organizations. Recognizing that different conversations have different reasons for taking place, but often you have a limited amount of time to search for and identify key points of insight, either learning from someone else or learning about them. How do you now approach a conversation to get the most value out of it?
Hi, Jeremy Smith of Civitech. I definitely approach different conversations differently. Yesterday, for example, I was interviewing a potential employee for Graphicacy after the rest of the team had already given me their thoughts. So I was looking very specifically for that person's fit with our team, with our mission, whether I thought they were going to stick around for a while, and digging in about a few things that others at Graphicacy wanted me to ask about. I was also doing what I could to learn how this candidate tackled thinking about preparing for an uncertain future. After a few pretty expansive answers by the candidate, I agreed with my team's recommendation to hire. A podcast interview is a little different, of course. With those, I'm trying to get an understanding of the person's intellectual, political, maybe entrepreneurial development so that I and my audience can know where they're coming from. And then I'm trying to understand how they fit in with other people and organizations that are part of our big ecosystem. I like that the long format gives me the opportunity to explore that in reasonably leisurely style. Some years ago, I interviewed
the Washington Post investigative journalist Carol Lenig for my podcast, episode number 493. I enjoyed getting her story and asking her about her book about Trump, just getting to know her path through life better. Later, she introduced me to another reporter, Michael Isikoff. After I interviewed him, Carol asked me by email, "What news did you or he break?" Well, I had never approached any interview with the idea that I was trying to break news exactly. I'm trying to learn things, but sometimes I'm asking questions about things I already know, but would like others to hear from my guest. I think my work is different in that I'm not pursuing a specific story where I need a quote to make my point, but I do have various themes I'm exploring for the podcast. So I'm still pondering Carol's question and yours. Am I doing a good enough job seeking new insights in these conversations or breaking news as she would have it? What do you folks think? Happy to hear suggestions.
This is Ken Grossinger. Nathaniel, after 1,000 podcasts, what have you learned?
Hi, Ken of Democracy Partners. When I first got this question, I confess that I found it so broad as to be almost annoying, with the annoying part directed at my own skills of synthesis. It's a bit like the three questions I fielded in part two of this three-part episode, which my sister and two others asked me how I've changed my mind over the years. Or maybe similar to how I just answered Amanda above. It's hard to summarize what I've learned. I've learned that I like to interview people and I'm not too bad at it. I've learned that progressive political entrepreneurship is flourishing, even or perhaps because of the relatively dark time in our politics. I had no idea of the scale and scope of this work when I started in the spring of 2017. I also have a much greater understanding, as we all do, of the other side and the threat they pose and what we are all doing to counter it. What I haven't learned is what will be the great antidote to all of this problematic political behavior that we see. I guess we need to keep at it and continue exploring what works to bring us to a more positive tomorrow.
Nathaniel Perlman. It is Stephanie Shriok. Yes, former president of Emily's List, former chief of staff for John Tester, former campaign manager for John Tester, former development director for Howard Dean. Oh my God, Nathaniel, we're old. We've done too much stuff. You've done 1,000 episodes. How is that even possible? And why have I only had one? I think I should get at least one more episode. And we can talk about how the Democratic Party and so many of the fantastic operatives who we call friends, and they are our friends, keep refusing to focus on the fact that abortion is going to win this election because we need access and they stole our rights. So you and me, brother, let's have a conversation. And by the way, huge, huge congratulations on a great podcast.
Hi, Stephanie. Even though you have a pretty long and illustrious career, from what I hear, you're far from done. People should listen to episode 874, where I asked you about your career and a lot of other matters. And of course, I'd love to have you back on the podcast to discuss abortion in 2024 or anything else. By the way, because you said we are both old, I just made the mistake of looking up your age on Wikipedia and discovered that I'm nearly 8 years older than you. So I'm afraid that I'm the only one of the two of us who's old. Drat it. Since the assignment was to ask me a question, I will take yours to be, why is it that some elements of our party are resisting a focus on abortion in this campaign? I know that you worked to drive the issue into prominence during the 2022 midterm, and I know that a lot of leaders in key campaigns felt that it was critical to their success. Despite that, from what I hear, there is some disagreement about how successful the issue of abortion was for us in the 2022 midterms. Unfortunately, I am not a campaign manager or a political consultant, unlike you. When I quite recently interviewed the longtime election analyst Charlie Cook, he said rather strenuously that people are wrong who think that millions and millions of voters turned out on the abortion issue because of the Dobbs decision. He told me, that didn't happen, it just flat didn't happen. Cook's point was based on the fact that Democratic turnout was down 10 million voters in 2022 from 2018. Cook said, we beat midterm expectations only where we faced what he labeled exotic and potentially problematic candidates, by which he means the Kari Lakes of the world. Now, I don't think Those numbers prove Charlie's point, because they do not say where we would have been without that Supreme Court decision, nor our emphasis on it. And I'm sure we'd rather fight 2024 on the abortion terrain than on the fronts that Trump wants us to. Further, there is also the question of doing what is right and using the campaign to educate voters about the loss of their rights. It is obvious from statements by Trump and other Republican strategists that they're worried about their disadvantage on this issue. I'm no expert here. You are. Why do you think some of our strategists are less keen on this issue? Is it a holdover from pre-Dobbs wisdom? Is it men who are less worried about the issue? Is it a desire to focus on Trump's threat to democracy? I've also seen some discussion that democracy plus abortion, as important as they both are not enough, and that we need to fight on the economy, etc. as well. I'm ready for the episode where we discuss all this.
This is Ben, your brother. I'm just wondering, what changes in your approach when you're interviewing a friend, a former employee, a sponsor, or a competitor? What are the ethical obligations that come with running a podcast that touches on politically charged topics?
Hey, Ben. Thanks for the question. That gives me a chance to talk about another type of consideration I have in working on this podcast. First, I try not to change my approach when I interview different people, though obviously the more I know a person in advance, the more I probably know what to ask. I consider The Great Battlefield to be a friendly forum, and if you have listened to a reasonable number of my interviews, I think you'll agree that I try to give people a chance to put themselves in their best light, while sometimes asking harder questions that I think this niche audience would want me to ask. And so I try to be open with my guests and audience about what background or relationships that I have that might possibly influence how I ask questions, letting people know this is a former employee or a friend, a professor I studied with, or that I know a competitor of theirs or the like. I aim to be friendly and inquisitive to everyone, though obviously I am more or less skeptical of different people depending on what I already hear or know going into the interview or what I think of what someone is saying during it. And from time to time, I ask around among people I know for suggestions of questions to ask an upcoming guest. When I have questions about how to behave in particular instances, I go to you and our sister Eve and our dad, who are some of the members of my informal ethics committee. Fortunately, the value of an interview on my podcast or how I treat someone during it is quite a low stakes matter, conferring very modest benefits indeed, but it's still one I try to be careful about. As to other principles, my main position, as I try to make clear to everyone I talk to these days, is that I'm interested in helping anyone working for the good of the progressive democratic technology space and the ecosystem more broadly, and I'm happy to give my best advice to anyone that wants to ask me and is willing to listen, and I'm lucky to be in a position where I'm not particularly motivated by the success of any single firm or enterprise, but rather in how we all work together collectively to further the cause. I've had a steadily decreasing connection to NGP Van over these years. I was not financially fully disentangled till 2018, when my last bit of stock was sold, but I had stopped working there as an employee or a board member in about 2015, and I've had almost no influence over that company for years before that. I made it clear to my guests in that area of the market that I was quite enjoying taking off that company's hat, and I tried to balance a feeling of historical loyalty with opportunities to demonstrate my independence, including interviewing a number of people who irritated folks at that company. Recently, under the Bonterra name and style of management, I find it much easier to advise leaders at companies that are competing with some part of the Bonterra NGP Van suite of products, and at the same time, to stay in touch with my friends who are current or former Bonterra. Along the way, I've become friends with, invested modestly in, or served as a formal or informal advisor to a number of progressive political entrepreneurs, sometimes after learning about them during a podcast interview. That includes Mike at Illumis, Tudor at Socha, Nico Mealy, Danny at Grassroots Analytics, Alex at Ballot Ready, Cheyenne at Unified, and plenty of others who I've met with, taken walks with, or communicated with in other ways. I take care with confidential information, and it's a relatively small space, so I just try to be open about the things I can. Recently, for example, I interviewed Walter Lay of Ballot Builder. I mentioned to him beforehand that I was friends with Alex of Ballot Ready and to be ready for questions about the competitive space. He was fine with that. I often find myself coaching people to speak more gently of their competition, as we're all on the same team ultimately, and I don't love it when we disparage each other. In summary, Ben, I try to do the right things for the podcast while reserving the right to help our political entrepreneurs further their missions and those of the progressive ecosystem more broadly. I welcome any questions on this subject.
Hi, this is Josh from Graphicacy. For your 1,000th episode, I was wondering about how data-driven visual communication serves us in a world of political misinformation.
Hi, Josh. It's a good question, and no surprise that I would think you're onto something here. It's a challenging time to think about how to communicate with facts and real information when there's so much evidence of the effectiveness of lies and emotional appeals to the worst in us. I read a study recently that showed that interactive visualization of data and research led to much better recall of presented information than did plain text or static visualizations. That study found that numbers became more palatable to readers when they can focus and interact with them, for example. Maybe our friends in the progressive ecosystem and those working to combat rampant mis- and disinformation should be investing in more data-driven interactive communications and data-driven visual storytelling tools to drive action and impact or explain things.
Hey, Nathaniel, this is media and digital consultant John Rowley, my company's Counterpoint Messaging. I have a lot of questions for you. I think you're going to have me back on just so I can ask you all these questions, but here you go. Nathaniel, if you had to do it all over again, how would you have begun the podcast effort differently? What would you do differently? And then I would say, what are the common ingredients of a really good interview and a really bad interview?
Hi, John. Thanks for your questions about the podcast. And you'll definitely have to come back on the show sometime and we can discuss other matters. If I were starting this podcast over, yes, I probably would change a few things. Some are technical. Like at the beginning, I was advised to host the podcast on SoundCloud because it was inexpensive. I think that was a mistake in terms of getting reliable statistics. Also, I've mainly used Zencastr as my remote interviewing platform. And while it's worked fine 95% of the time, there are enough struggles with it that I think I'd now try out one of the competitors which have come along. I would also reconsider and revisit the format of interviews and how many to do a week. From the start, I should have provided transcripts, written commentary, a newsletter, show notes, or some other auxiliary pieces that other more professional podcasts seem to have. Now, I'll never catch up on them. Another thing I've thought about is breaking Great Battlefield into multiple podcasts based on the different themes that I cover. So I could have one on political reform, one on political analytics, one on political technology, one on democracy, etc., rather than mingling them all together. Of course, some people will just pick those that are interesting and helpful to them, but maybe a set of more focused podcasts would hold attention better. On the other hand, I'm fine with my decision to avoid news-related material or political red meat that might pull in a wider audience. I think there's plenty of that out there already. I also could have put more effort into pursuing sponsors. I really have not approached this as a business venture or with a set of goals about how to make it grow. For me, it's been more exploratory, learning, and a bit of a donation to the space for whatever that's been worth. I do enjoy it when someone other than Timeplots and Graphicacy sponsors some episodes. So maybe, based on these speculations, I'll make changes down the line, but not sure when or if that will happen. As to the common ingredients of a good or bad interview, I don't love interviewing people who are too practiced or who just return to talking points. So I try to come at things from a different angle. Also, people who are not very forthcoming are tough. A good interviewee tells stories and paints a picture and can convey emotion. A lot of things I'm not too good at myself, but I admire greatly when I hear them.
It's Will Robinson. So my question is, if we could get into a time machine and go 20 years into the future, what would you say is the most significant thing that happened in 2024?
Hi, Will, of the new media firm, and one of the first 50 guests on this show, it's easy to think right now that the most significant thing that will have happened in 2024 will be the fall election results. We had a little back and forth about your question by instant message, and I think your point is a good one, that with the lens of time, other things might come to seem as significant or more so than just who won. When people think of the 1960 election, for example, some think of it as much as the first television election as it was about JFK beating Nixon. It's certainly the case that what transpires in history over the next 20 years will shape how we look back at 2024. Will we have spent 20 years slipping further into right-wing authoritarianism? Will it have been a turning point when we barely elected Biden, but then made strides in climate policy that turned things around? Did some scandal with deep fakes or AI or disinformation become the October surprise that resulted in huge reforms to the election system, or a missed opportunity to fix things, and the beginning of an out-of-control spiral in that area going forward? Will it be the start of two decades with one party or the other in the wilderness? Was the most memorable thing in 2024, looking back from the future, the escalation of the Ukraine conflict or the widening of the Gaza conflict in the Middle East? Will 2024 be the sign of a big realignment in the coalitions in American politics? Is this turning point in AI this year the big thing? Is some discovery in the medical or energy sciences the thing that will have been the most significant in 2024? Check back in 20 years for the answer. And I sure hope that keeping Trump away from power this year will be part of the story then as well.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Deepak. I'm curious what you think we need to do to combat the rising tide of authoritarianism here in the United States. Obviously, this has a political manifestation, but it has deeper roots. So I'm curious, what's the strategy for those of us who care about equality and democracy? What should we be doing?
Hi, Deepak Bhargava, co-author of Practical Radicals and newly at JPG Foundation. This is obviously a central question these days. Off the top of my head, I think we need to find a way to separate conservatism from authoritarianism. I don't think real conservatives actually want what authoritarians bring. I think we need better civic education. I think we need real conversation across political divides. And I do not think it helps to demonize people who vote the wrong way temporarily, but are good people. I think we need to isolate the Trumpists and have a broad coalition against them. I think we need to get back to talking about the virtues of diversity. I think we need to look at what things we do as progressives that alienate too many people. And I think we need to govern well for those who need it when we have the chance so they can see the difference. And using a little humor to expose the other side wouldn't hurt. Not sure this adds up to a strategy, though. What is your answer?
Hi, this is Paige Gardner of PSG Consulting and the founder of the Voter Participation Center and the Center for Voter Information. I'm here on the 1,000th episode of the Great Battlefield podcast. I've been thinking a lot about the American electorate. It's usually divided into base voters, those who lean towards one candidate or another, and those who are swing voters or persuadable voters. There's another group that we have paid little attention to, and that is what I call double negative voters. They don't like Trump, they don't like President Biden, they may stay home or vote for a third party. They may be a quarter of the electorate in 2024. Some of them are hard dislikes, you will never get them. But there are those who might just hold their nose and vote for one of the two major party candidates. Here's the question. If you were President Biden's campaign manager, what steps would you take to minimize their support of third parties and maximize support for your candidacy?
Hi, Paige. First of all, I'm kind of fascinated by the 2% of the electorate that, according to Pew, has positive views of both Biden and Trump. Do these double positives actually exist? How are we going to win them over? Now, as to your question, I'm wondering how spotlighting the so-called double negatives is a useful lens through which to look at the electorate. It seems like we need to focus on the fairly large subset of these double negatives who are Democratic leaners that need to come home to their underlying party preference. I do think it's interesting to watch what Trump just started doing in his messaging around Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in attacking him as a liberal Democrat. I'm curious to see what that does and what our equivalent move might be. I think we ignore these third-party candidates at our peril, especially with this many people looking for a political home, and with several of the third-party candidates on the left. But since I don't have much expertise here in public opinion or political strategy, you should come back on the show, tell us what you think.
Nathaniel, you've interviewed everybody in this industry, and every firm, every organization says that they have the answer to the problems of the Democratic Party. But they don't seem to even agree on what the question is. Some folks say that they were going to solve the organizing problem, the fundraising problem, the messaging problem, the candidate problem. They're going to increase voter turnout. They're going to increase persuasion. So if you were the head of Shark Tank Democracy, what would you say the question is? What is the number one problem that you think we need to solve on the Democratic side?
Hi, Sri. I understand your frustration, especially as a former candidate for Congress. Let's say that our number one problem right now is coalition cohesion, getting us all on the same page that we need to win this one together and putting aside temporarily other political differences that pull us apart. I'm not sure that Shark Tank Democracy is necessarily the way to address that, though I would like to see increased funding of things like think tanks and groups working on their parts of political strategy that binds us together. Can we get campaigns coming from the top down to meet people coming from the bottom up to pull together against Trump and pick Team Sanity? We will need everyone out there who has various parts of the answer working, but we all will be more successful if the big national campaign strategy fits the moment.
So you asked me where 5-10 years down the line, I see the role of AI or the new types of technology in this space. Having been such a formative part of the political tech landscape from the very beginning of political tech being a thing, what do you think can or should change the most in the next 5 years?
Well, Hillary Lair of Quiller, whatever part I played in building our political technology ecosystem, I didn't come in at the beginning. The use of computers in politics goes back at least to around when I was born, when Winthrop Rockefeller ran in 1966 for governor of Arkansas and used computers for list management. As to what I think should change in our political technology landscape in the next 5 to 10 years, well, I hope we can find a way to be a combination of more integrated and more distributed. A big problem for a long time has been, how do we share information? That is, how do we centralize it to standardize it and make it available to all who need it? And at the same time, how do we incorporate innovation broadly, not just around the holder of that data, to allow the incentives of the market and people's commitment to winning to flourish so that they can try their own ideas and then fit them in and share them and apply them broadly? And sometimes that sharing or openness runs counter to the incentives of a particular firm or some elements of the party or other entities that are part of the process. So I hope that we get better and better at developing an ecosystem that works to generate improvement and pull it together so that it's more valuable to all of us. It's a very interesting time right now, with some people working hard on the data integration problem, some people generating new tools that produce their own data, and there's an ongoing push and pull of incentives and endeavors that leave some elements of this unsorted. But generally, I think we're on a promising path. I hope we can continue to navigate it fruitfully.
Hey, Nathaniel, if you were building a tool now, what challenges in the progressive space would you take on? And why?
Hi, Ari of Open Field. I appreciate the question. I think if I were starting again, I'd try to figure out what the next generation of tool is going to be. Something that's not a redoing of what's gone before, not list management in its various incarnations, but looking for a way to leapfrog the current concepts and technologies to help people connect together in a new and healthy way for mutual applied political education and action, so that we can collectively work to make this a better place. There are a number of people working on things like that with different ideas, and I'm hopeful that someone will strike it right. But healthy connection and political education quite obviously needs a ton of fleshing out and could come from a multitude of directions. So let me know if anyone you know is working on something in this area so I can highlight it.
This is Mike Fole with Empower Project, your friends in relational organizing. Congratulations on 1,000 episodes. Given all the great people and organizations you've talked to over the years, what do you wish you could go back in time to tell your younger self when you started politics to make sure you'd have the biggest impact?
Hi, Mike. I knew precious little when I got going compared to what I know now, but I've always had a realistic sense that what I was doing would be modest in political impact in a big country. And my ambitions were never large, and that extends through to today. My attitude has been to keep plugging away, doing a little bit each day, picking my spots, and hoping that that would add up to something over time that contributes to moving things in the right direction. Maybe that's been limiting. So knowing what I know now, I would tell myself to have a little more faith that I had what it took to tackle bigger things. I hope someone else, young now as I was back then, who perhaps is not as confident or as ambitious as they should be hearing this, might realize that about themselves and set their sights higher.
Hello, hello. This is Zoe Stein. What's something going on in the ecosystem that made you think, oh man, wow, I might be missing out by not being a part of that?
Hi, Zoe, relational organizing guru. Thanks for the question. And I know there's a whole lot going on with you right now, so I hope I'll have the chance to have you back on to discuss things, maybe after the election. There are lots of things in the ecosystem that I wish I were part of, at least as an observer with the right to make suggestions. Early in the 2008 campaign for president, I remember Mike Henry, who was Hillary's deputy campaign manager at the time, I think, making the point to a large meeting that he wanted people to, quote, stay in their own lanes. My lane was technology, but of course there was part of me that wanted to be heard on political strategy, even though I was unqualified. That campaign was weird because almost all the scheduled senior staff meetings were canceled, and I got very little visibility into how decisions were made. I haven't been public until now about the number of times that Hillary called me personally, going around her campaign manager and all the senior consultants, asking for advice on campaign priorities and strategies. That number was not large. So while I have a lot of experience being in the room when political business decisions or technology decisions are being made, and sometimes being the final decision maker there, I have almost none on the political front, so sometimes I feel I have missed out. My knowledge about political decision making is very secondhand, from reading history, political science, or journalism, or for talking to hundreds of operatives. So I've carried a bit of an unrealized desire to sit in on campaign strategy calls or the meetings where progressive political groups of all sorts decide things, or to test my mettle making political ads or communications. But not so much that I haven't been pretty comfortable without the responsibility, and I truly don't love meetings. I'm closer to qualified to weigh in on donor and political tech funder debates, political tech product design meetings, hiring decisions, or thinking about how to improve progressive organizations. So I really do enjoy the opportunity through this podcast to brainstorm with people in leadership roles about how they might solve various problems. And I envy people like you, Zoe, who are actively working to win elections using your developed expertise. Keep it up.
When you were building NGP, what was the most difficult decision that you made along the way? And what was the most important decision that you made along the way?
Hi, Mike Phillips, the political researcher who built Illumis, a public data platform that's been used by the research function of a lot of democratic political organizations. The most important decision I made when I was building NGP was made at the outset, and that was to build it as a partisan Democratic Party and Allies only firm. This also probably doesn't seem like a decision at all in the current environment, but at the time, that was not how the market was generally organized in campaign software. The two largest companies back then, Aristotle and Hannibal, sold to both parties. There were few partisan firms back then, too, as there are a few nonpartisan firms now, like NationBuilder, but the conventional wisdom was that it did not make sense to cut off half your potential market. But when I started NGP, I decided that I was only interested in helping one side, and that definitely assisted us in forging relationships in the space and helped us be attractive to committed employees. We certainly would not have been a fit for merging with VAN, which was started a number of years later than us as Democratic also, And as the company grew, there's never been a thought of working with the Republicans by anyone who understands NGP Van the slightest, something that's continued to this day, and I believe that it helped that company grow. I think this success also played some role in shaping the decisions of later political entrepreneurs who wanted to align with us. So that turned out to be an important call for the space. Mike, I think the most difficult decision that I made also really dates me. It was the decision to build a web-based application from scratch when we had a successful client-server application that ran on local networks and computers and was dominating the Democratic market for fundraising and compliance. There was very little demand yet in the political world for software as a service and a great deal of skepticism about data safety compared to hosting it on your own private network. But it was clear that that was the way the world was heading, so I decided to invest our profits in building a web-based version of what we already had. And we didn't know what we were doing, so it didn't go altogether smoothly. But eventually we had a product, and we were migrating the most forward-looking clients first, like Senate Majority Leader Daschle or Howard Dean for president, and eventually almost everyone to the new product. In retrospect, it probably seems like a no-brainer, but it was a hard decision at the time and very akin to many decisions made to invest in new things all the time around the ecosystem.
Hey, Nathaniel, Amy Pritchard here from Gain Power and Amplify Power. I am old enough to remember how you got your start in politics, or maybe that's not really true, but how you founded and really solidified NGP as the go-to software for compliance, and obviously was around when you partnered with Van and have watched the company grow ever since, and really up until it got bought by Bonterra, was a huge fan. And I'm not saying I'm not now, I just have some concerns about perhaps how the company is involved relative to its position in the Democratic and progressive space. And so, but I'm mostly curious about your own feelings about where NGP is now, how it's grown since you were able to sell it, and how it has changed perhaps since it was under your control.
Hi, Amy. I'll take a swing at this second question of yours about NGP. The concerns you expressed are widely and increasingly shared, to my dismay. I hear them from many directions, even though people sometimes think they have to be careful what they say to me directly. Note that I have not had firsthand information for almost a decade. For a long time, I thought that what was being said or reported was unfair, spread by competitors or people jealous of the company's success. And I know from experience that it's hard to tell from the outside what's going on inside an institution when it faces challenges. For instance, there have been layoffs at a bunch of other sizable progressive organizations, and I don't know enough to judge them. Since I've received a number of questions for this episode on this subject, I'll just say in answer to your question that NGP Van is still important. It still has tremendous remaining value and resources, but it is foolishly painting a target on itself and inviting competition by what seems like egregious mismanagement. I hope they hold things together through this election. In fact, I expect that they will, and then listen to the remaining people they already employ who know what to do. They should give the NGP Van component of their business, which is still mostly solid, the autonomy and the resources they need to help their clients succeed. So how am I feeling generally on this subject? I'm disappointed and I'm worried and sometimes pissed off, and I'm watching the ecosystem work to backfill, but there's a lot left over there that ought to be saved and improved, and I hope that they really focus on solving that.
My understanding is that since you sold the company, you no longer have very much involvement, that occasionally you might give advice to the current owners or staff that are currently on the team there, but you're not involved at all. As the founder of this important entity, how does that make you feel, like to have this thing that is now out in the world, still serving the causes and candidates that you started the company to support, but that it's sort of gone beyond you? Do you have any regrets about that transition, or how does that make you feel?
Hi, Nathan. You're right that I no longer have any financial or advisory relationship with NGP Van Every Action. As I say in the answer to other questions in this area, I've been out for a while now. Because I'm obviously still very interested in what's going on in political technology, witness this podcast, I have to spend some time managing my thoughts about whatever legacy I have through having started the NGP part of that company. I'm proud of what I did building it and leaving it in good hands, and it's had a remarkably good run, and it has done a great deal of good in the world. I'm really grateful for the experience and the relationships and the learnings that I've taken from it. At the moment, I can't help but to be disappointed that so many apparent mistakes are being made. People in both the donor and entrepreneurial community have come to me, not infrequently, asking for advice on how to replace the firm or solve its perceived problems. And plenty are thinking about that who don't talk to me, I'm sure. For Bonterra, I think they are squandering value. The company is so important and currently so embedded and still so much bigger and more able than its wannabe successors that it really needs to turn itself around. I hope that we as a community on the outside can find a way to communicate to the leadership there that what they do matters and that they need to devote the leadership and resources to fixing things at NGP Van. And to the people inside, I hope they can find a way to do a similar job of persuasion while they are around. Or Bonterra should find someone else to take it off their hands and run it right.
Hi, my name is Danielle Nakano. I'm a former NGP Van employee. I was actually NGP employee number 3. I'm currently working at National Geographic Society. The question I'd like to ask is, what are you doing to help the Democratic Party move away from private equity, holding all of their data?
Hi, Danielle. I'm glad we've stayed friends all these years. And I know that we both have strong feelings about NGP that were formed by what a great experience it was to have been part of building that company, and the hard work and camaraderie that it represents to both of us. We both have many friendships that were born in that effort, and a lot of them continue. I know that you put a couple decades of your life into the company. We both have taken a lot of pride in that legacy, and we know well how many people it took working hard for all that time to create something important and meaningful and impactful. You've put your question in a provocative way, and I think it represents both a justified anger towards what has happened recently with the management of the company, now under the Bonterra name, the shocking loss of talented people that they've pushed out the door, the lack of investment and innovation in the political product line, the decline in the quality of technical support that we took so much pride in and that I emphasized for so many years. And from what I hear, choosing to create a debt burden that must be part of why layoffs seem necessary. And people tell me an intention to run a playbook of private equity software company change that does not sound like a good fit at all for the space we care about. So I have a lot of concerns about the direction of the company. I'll admit that these concerns are based on what I hear rather than firsthand knowledge. I also have friends that still work there who know what to do. So I hope they get listened to. And I know that there are a lot of mission-critical tools residing under that umbrella that no one is anywhere near being ready to replace broadly. However, of all my many concerns about NGP Van under Bonterra, the ownership of the data is not at the top of the list. Danielle, you know more about this than I do, but I think an increasing proportion of NGP Van customer data is also housed at other institutions. And my sense is that the leaders of NGP Van internally are still heading off decisions that might put data or uptime at risk in the short to medium term. And outside the company, the work is going on to build more flexible architecture around what cannot yet be replaced. We should talk offline about what your specific worries are. I'd love to see the current owners work to turn things around, or sell NGP Van to someone else who will. I think either would be wise business. I invite anyone at Bonterra, at the leadership level of NGP Van or above, to come talk to me in private, or publicly on my podcast about these issues, as many of its best representatives have done before.
Michelle Stevenson from Grow for Good Strategies. Okay, if you could have dinner with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be, why, and what do you imagine you would talk about?
Hi, Michelle. I struggled with this question. I thought about how awkward many of the possible dinners would actually be. I really don't want to have dinner with someone who would not want to have dinner with me, and that would take quite a few luminaries out of the picture. On the other hand, I've concluded that given the choice of dinner guest, dead or alive, I'd prefer live. I considered comedians because it seems like that would be fun, and I've been listening to a whole series of memoirs of comedians, and they have a special way of tangling with politics. So I settled on the intersection of politics and comedy and picked Al Franken, a former senator and comedian, and he has a podcast as well. Of course, I know enough not to try to compete with him to be funny over dinner. As to what we would talk about, after sharing the requisite personal secrets, we could tackle politics and how to get ourselves out of this fix that we're in this current moment. If any listener can set up that dinner, let me know. Or, as fallback, I'd like to interview him here.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Jerry Hauser of 2050 Advisors and formerly of the Management Center. Huge congratulations on your 1,000th episode. That is awesome. For my question, I'm going to go meta. What question has no one asked you yet that you think we should?
Hi, Jerry. You've been a management consultant to nonprofits for so many years, and I bet you get a lot of leaders and teams who are struggling with what they call work-life balance. So I'm going to use this question as an opportunity to discuss fun. I think there should be more fun and camaraderie at work. I think it's harder now in the world of virtual work to bond with your team and enjoy the social side. And I believe that that kind of bonding makes a big difference. In my companies, we were at our best usually when we had fun together. We played foosball, table tennis, we had parties, we built things out of clay, we went out to lunch together, we headed to company retreats at my farm or elsewhere, and all that made a big difference to me and I think to most others as well. Work is a big part of our life. It should be a place we want to be, and that environment is something that can be shaped uniquely for each organization by its people.
Daniel, congratulations on your 1,000th podcast episode. So my question for you is, who do you think wins this year with over 60 countries having elections in the global battle of democracy versus the demagogue? And personally, my question for you is, what do you do with boring interviewees?
Hi, Aaron Velarde. I hope things are going well at Vote Run Lead. As to your first question, I'm certainly aware that there are huge numbers of elections testing democracy versus authoritarianism around the world this year, but I have no sense of how it's going to go. I am rooting for democracy. As to the second part of your question, what to do with boring interviewees, maybe I can tackle that more fruitfully. First, I try to only invite or accept guests who seem to be doing something interesting. Second, the vast majority of them have turned out to be anything but boring. Third, when I'm interviewing someone and they seem pretty boring and I'm feeling a little disappointed during the hour that we were talking, when I go back to listen, I often discover that they were much better than I thought they were, and it was more to do with my mood at the time. My general attitude and philosophy is that pretty much everyone has a story and it's my job to elicit it. In a very few cases, when I have been frustrated by someone who refused to answer questions I considered basic, making the interview uninteresting, I've shelved that interview. Naturally, there are some people who have the ability to make anything they say interesting and others who are the opposite. I try to take it as a personal challenge to help make the latter show how interesting they really are.
Good afternoon, Mr. Perlman. Mike Madrid here. It was such a great time on your podcast going over all things democracy, and just wanted to first congratulate you on 1,000th episode. Tremendous work. A question that's been lingering in my mind since we had that discussion is really about democracy itself and whether or not this American society can sustain it. And so here's the question. As America moves into becoming a non-white majority country in the next 10 to 15 years, can we truly be an ethnically pluralistic society and rely on the same institutions, checks and balances, and representative government that served us well for the past 250 years? Was the questions that the founders were grappling with, namely that we are all endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights, more of a suggestion than a reality? And now that we're finally tested with it, when we're finally becoming something other than what we have always been, can we survive?
Hi, Mr. Madrid, co-founder of the Lincoln Project and an expert in Hispanics and American politics. I appreciate your question. I do think we are facing unprecedented challenges, and I do think we can survive, yes. And while our government did serve us well in many respects for the first 250 years, it also made many egregious mistakes and didn't live up to its ideals all the time. What is unprecedented is the potential return of a president who is unwilling to accept the results of an election he lost, and whose statements indicate his desire to wield power unconstrained by previous norms and rules. It could ultimately be as big a challenge as a civil war. I was much more comfortable when we had presidents like Bill Clinton saying things like, "We're all in this together," or Barack Obama saying, "Diversity makes us stronger," or George W. Bush saying, "Recognizing and confronting our history is important. Transcending our history is essential." Trump has played different cards, and it is not helpful. We need to get both parties back to the post-civil rights consensus of acknowledging the strength in our diversity. What would help us would be a political moment where, like after the Civil War, after the Great Depression, after Watergate, we got in a round of major political reforms at the national level that helped show that our democracy can renew itself. But it would take a hell of a shock to get the political majorities that would be required to do that if January 6th wasn't enough. It's probably going to require an electoral wipeout of the Trumpists, but we'll see. The reforms might include the national right to vote, automatic voter registration, national civic education, ranked choice voting, abolishment of the Electoral College, more support for better media, etc. I hope we can make that happen.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Chris, your podcast editor. My question would be, is there a question you haven't been asked that you would like to be asked?
Hi, Chris. Classic question. Something that I haven't been asked that I would like to be is, who should I thank for their help in making this podcast happen? I'd have to include you right at the top, as you've been my audio editor for many years now, as well as Dan Leone, who audio edited the first several hundred episodes. Both of you have been unbelievably reliable and skilled. I've never had to worry about things getting done. And in fact, you've often prompted me that I haven't yet recorded an intro or provided an edited transcript on time, keeping me on track. Thanks much. Next, I have to thank my guests for the work that they do in the world, for progress as they see it, and for the time they took to sit with me and talk about it. My guests have helped also, making one interview lead to another by introducing me to others. I'd also like to thank everyone who provided the questions for this episode and the two that were attached to it. I appreciate the thoughtfulness and the variety. If listeners have other questions, feel free to send them. Maybe someday I'll make another episode using them if there's interest. Thank you to the sponsors, including my own companies. If you would like your enterprise to sponsor some episodes also, please let me know. And special thanks to my voiceover talent, who've done my various sponsorship ads. That's my wife, Connie, and my daughter, Ella. The clarinet music is Improvisation on a Marshall Theme by Paul Harvey and is played by Elizabeth Widzinski and used by permission. Thanks, Elizabeth. I really appreciate people who listen, especially those who've taken the time to send me messages and give me feedback. To those of you who have only lurked to this point, take the time to write me at nperlman@gmail.com or message me on LinkedIn. It's so nice to hear from folks. Finally, I want to thank my family, who've put up with me constantly ducking out for interviews, hurriedly reading my guests' books into the night, and for giving me space to dominate the couch as I edit through yet another episode. Most of all, I have to thank them for sometimes taking an interest when I excitedly describe the career arc of my latest guest and what I learned about that person and their organization that I found inspiring. Much appreciation, Chris, to you and to everyone else I mentioned.
Hey, Nathaniel, it's Connie. Here's my question. How do you balance the personal and the political in 2024? Inquiring minds want to know.
Hi, Connie. There's a lot I have left to learn, but one thing I know is that when you ask your wife for a question to include in your podcast, it might be wise to have that question bat cleanup in the third part of your 1,000th episode. So thanks for asking a very pertinent question. If we were to believe the people who think that Trump and the Trumpists put our democracy at risk, and I've been one of those people saying that, then his defeat is such a national priority that you could argue that it's hard to justify working on or giving our attention to anything else. We have all the regular political and policy reasons to beat Trump and the Republicans this year, plus the extraordinary fact that he's an obvious danger to our republic. We cannot risk another 4 years of his narcissism and his authoritarian instincts. This priority for us is especially true for people who are political professionals, where their collective job performance could conceivably make a determinative difference in the outcomes. That puts a lot of pressure on us all. In such an environment, should people still continue to do their laundry, take out the garbage, protect their mental health, do their day job, and take care of themselves and others in all the ways that we know are the right ways to live? So the answer is, even in a rolling crisis politically, we need to continue to live our normal lives and not sacrifice those around us. We don't individually have so much influence that we can't be missed for a few hours, and we cannot do our jobs well if we're not rested and supportive of each other. It's time to work smart, not just hard, and to contribute as makes sense. At a bare minimum, that means exercising our vote. A vote for Biden, who's been a good president, is a vote against Trump. Do not sit this one out. So if there are any inquiring minds about managing the personal and the political in this time of challenge, I say keep working hard in politics, but don't neglect yourself or your other responsibilities. No matter which way things go this fall, you'll be needed when the fight continues. Love to you, Connie, and to anyone listening as well. That was Nathaniel G. Perlman in the third part of my 1,000th episode. Hope you enjoyed this excursion in the podcast. And if you like this and didn't listen to episode 1,000 parts 1 and 2, you might go back and try them. But now I return to interviewing others. You can find me at greatbattlefield.com or graphicacy.com. And I appreciate feedback, so send me reactions, good or bad.